Welcome to Ferment Radio. I am your host Aga Pokrywka and my guest today is Mateusz Kędzior. Mateusz is a postdoctoral fellow with Betulka Charles Research Group at the University of Arizona, United States. Somewhere between sci-fi and astrobiology's high-tech, this research team tries to find an answer to seemingly basic questions like, where do we come from? What are we? Where are we going? Microorganisms seem to have the answers, but these scientists need to find a way to decode them.
Yeah, my name is Mateusz Kędzior, and I'm a postdoc in the laboratory of Betulka Charles at the University of Arizona right now. I work in the field of astrobiology, trying to know more about the history of life on Earth, on the origins of life, studying the microbes and trying to resurrect and study the ancient variants of current biological molecules, which are proteins.
I've been reading through the articles you sent me. Mm-hmm. One caught my attention and I will read it because it sounds like amazing. It sounds like sci-fi. I love it, but I also kind of don't understand what this all means. I will read it now. A resurrected gene brought back from the dead in the lab is allowing molecular biologists to travel billions of years into the past to study one of the most significant transitions in Earth's history. Wow, like, I love it. It sounds like a beginning of a movie. That something amazing will happen. Could you say something more about that?
Basically, what we do in our lab, first, we try to infer the sequences of ancient, it sounds like some sci-fi, as you mentioned, but really scientific, because based on the currency of existing extant species, we are able, through phylogenetic study, to infer the sequences of the genes and then proteins which have existed before. It's called inference because we are not really showing the sequences which have really existed back then. It's impossible to really show them. You don't have any remains of the past life present in here and now to be able to extract sequences of ancient DNA, except for a few cases, like in glaciers. You can hear that some scientists find relics of the past organisms, some microbes or some other ones, or in ember structures, but those are sporadic cases. In general, if you want really to track the history of some gene or genes, I also mean the sequences of those proteins which determine the functions of our bodies, enzymes and different other building blocks of our body. To be able to track the history of such proteins, if we want to know how they evolved, how they really started, we have to travel back in time to several moments, especially when we want to see the effect of some and how they impacted the evolution of those proteins. We have to try to infer the structures of them, which dated back to those moments of history where something huge happened, like the appearance of oxygen on Earth, which changed totally all of the transition of anaerobic, where such structures really existed. This also leads to my interest right now in my lab. It's about Rubisco protein. Rubisco is one of the most preserved enzymes that have ever existed, which fixes carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. It converts carbon dioxide, which is a gas, into the biomass. It's done by photoautotrophic organisms, like plants, algae, or cyanobacteria. Cyanobacteria is my model organism. Rubisco protein, it converts carbon dioxide into sugars, into the energy for the cyanobacterium. Since sugars are carbohydrates, they are the compounds made of carbon, carbon in the rocks, you can trace the life. You can synthesize the gene. It doesn't exist, so you can't isolate it from any living organism. So you synthesize the infrastructure of ancient gene, and you introduce this gene into the living microbe, which will produce the protein based on the instruction in the gene. So then you have the revival of the protein. So it's called resurrection because you bring back to life the protein based on the instruction provided in the gene, which this gene, which is ancient in here. So you create some hybrids of the modern organism, which bears the ancient one particular gene. And you can see the crosstalk between the gene, ancient gene, and the modern environment, so modern genome. And both of them are affected. My PI, the tool, was able to infer the structure of such ancient gene, and she introduced a modern bacterium, and she observed that it doesn't prosper really well. It stopped dividing. Initially, it just basically stopped to grow, but it survived. And eventually, the nature found its way here because both the genome got adapted to the ancient gene, and the gene itself underwent some mutations to adapt to the modern environment. So in the end, the bacterium restarted to grow. And when Betul checked the sequences, she found some mutations. So the gene accumulated some particular mutations, and the genome also in response did the same. And you, by studying those mutations, where they took place, you can try to predict the mechanism underlying this adaptation. You can predict the role of this particular protein it could have played in the past.
It seems that the research you are involved with concerns a lot of various disciplines. To me, it's already like a trace of synthetic biology or astrobiology. Could you tell more, maybe, what kind of disciplines are being you and probably they are also having quite various backgrounds.
Beginning from the inference of the ancient structures, ancestral structures of the proteins and genes, first you are introduced in our lab to computational biology. So it's about phylogenetic study, computational analysis to infer the structure based on the comparison of different variants of the gene or protein. From different species, you recreate the phylogenetic tree, and then you find the nodes at this phylogenetic tree, which represent the ancestral proteins or genes. So computational study, I know that programming skills are really welcome here to organize the data, like Python skills, I know that they are really beneficial to have. So you start from this step. The next one would be to employ here chemical synthesis. So you order the synthesis of the gene, and the gene is synthesized, and then you have this gene, and you have to find a way to incorporate it into the genome of the modern bacterium. So then comes genetics and genetic engineering to find a way to successfully insert your gene into the genome of the bacterium so it survives still. When you introduce this ancient gene, you have the microbe which contains both ancient variant and the new one. And there is no way of studying the performance and the values of the ancient gene when you still have the modern one, which can mask the activity of the previous one. And so you have to excise it, and you find a way to really get rid of it. And then once you succeed, you have this ancient gene present there, and the bacterium, your host, can produce it. Then comes biochemistry. You can study the protein itself. What's its activity? Does it perform better or worse than the original gene? You can compare them. And I also have people with major backgrounds. Oh, in geology, this is another important skill, another science involved. You try to find the direct evidence of the past in the environment also, right? So studying the atmosphere and rocks helps to find the background for the genes, to find some information about the native environment for those resurrected genes and proteins. We can learn from each other. It's very nice because me as a microbiologist, I can learn other components of our study. Oh, and speaking of microbiology, this is another field of study involved because you deal with hosts, which are microbes, usually microbes, because those are most primitive forms like bacteria that have existed on Earth. So if we are interested in studying origins of life, it's natural that we choose bacteria as our model organisms because they are the nature hosts for some ancient genes like Rubisco, the one I study. It was produced by bacteria before plants even have started to exist. So billions of years ago, even before the appearance of oxygen, cyanobacteria already were there to produce, to fix carbon dioxide.
How so old, so ancient microbes are differing from the contemporary ones? Because we talk here about evolution, which usually impose that if something evolves, it usually becomes more perfect. But does it apply also to the bacteria in such a huge time frame? Like, how did they change? How did they evolve?
Mm-hmm. Bacteria have extremely high rate of mutations, so they evolve very quickly. The one I mentioned, E. coli, it has a doubling time of about 30 minutes. So every 30 minutes, it means you have another generation of this bacterium. So parents give they give the beginning to the another generation every 30 minutes. So the rate of mutation is very high here. And because they adapt very quickly, they can survive in extreme environments. And they are the first one to have the highest success in surviving different disasters, even because they respond very quickly to what's happening. If you trace back the ancestry of some modern bacteria, you can find them to be related to some organism which you would never believe that they could be related. The good example is based on my experience, because before I joined this lab, I worked with Chlamydia trachomatis. It's a sexually transmitted bacterium. And it appears that this bacterium and cyanobacterium that I'm working with right now, they used to have a common ancestor. So they are basically cousins. But because the rate of evolution of bacteria is so high, they evolved in such different ways that cyanobacterium is a photoautotrophic organism, which fixes carbon dioxide to produce its own food, where chlamydia is an obligate pathogen of mammals and humans, of course, among them. So it depends on the host. It has to infect cells to really survive and multiply. So such totally different way of lifestyle of the bacterium, but they both originate from common ancestor. And there is a proof of that. Both types of bacteria, they have genes in their genome that are found also in plants. Chlamydia never chose the plant cell as its host, but this event of entering plant cells happened later than the lineages diverged, giving rise to those different species like cyanobacteria species and chlamydia. So based on this example, you can see how they can eat what they are right now.
So if we would abstract it, we could even say that those microbes, they have some sorts of a memory if you are able to trace their ancestors. Would you agree with this kind of a metaphor?
They haven't changed totally. They still have the same, I would call it template, so instructions, especially for the crucial genes that play the major roles to sustain life. This didn't change. So they have the instructions from the past, but those templates they used to build subsequent stories to change according to the changing environment. And but yeah, the memory in form of basic instructions. So in DNA, you can track them. I think in this context, I can clearly see the memory of the past, and that's how we reconstruct the genes. So you take the present sequences and believing that they have the some leftovers of the past, you are able to go back in time. Once you are able to find the sequence in the most recent ancestor of them, you step by step you are reversing the process of evolution and looking at their former forms. If they didn't have the memory at all, we wouldn't be able to really with high confidence infer the previous structures. So it's all based on the history which is present in the modern genomes of those bacteria, but also in all of our genomes, because we come from some ancestors. So we have those ancestral templates which we build on by changing them to survive in our present environment.
How far into the past you've managed to go in your research? Because we operate here with like enormous numbers, but would you be able to specify how many, probably billions, right? Is it the right number? Years ago, were you working with bacteria?
Yeah, you are able to go billions of years into the past. Betul was able to show to infer the structure of Rubisco that dated back to the times before the great oxidation event. So definitely more than 2.5 billion of years ago. So very long time when there were no eukaryotic forms and still before the endosymbiotic event, before bacteria gave rise to chloroplasts or mitochondria, those structures which are believed to have originated from microbes and are present in our eukaryotic cells.
I can imagine that if we start to do this kind of research, it also brings a question for alternative evolutions. Like, what if this microbe would evolve differently? Would it bring us to a different place? Is it something which also is a question in the research you do, or?
Exactly. In evolutionary biology and experimental evolutionary biology, yeah, we ask this question here very often. And yes, my lab is also interested in replaying the evolution and seeing its effect. Replaying, it means you infer the structure of some ancient protein and you introduce it into the microbe, modern microbe, so it has the modern context. So this is the selective pressure for it. The selection drives evolution, right? So you culture such bacteria with ancestral gene, and after multiple generation, you see how this gene evolves. Starting from some point in the past, let's say we start from the gene which dates back to 2 billion of years ago, you culture the bacteria bearing this gene, and after hundreds or thousands of generations, you test how this gene adapted to its modern environment, modern genome, and you can see if it underwent the changes, mutations, which already happened to the real gene, that the modern variant of this resurrected gene has the same changes. So then you can conclude that the evolution was deterministic. Again, we could replay the same or similar kind of evolution. However, you may end up having a different variant with different mutations at different positions. And the evolved gene and encoded protein, they will be totally different from the alternative we have right now in the nature. So it would tell you that the evolution took totally different trajectory. And so it would mean that evolution of this protein is not really deterministic. It's contingent upon chance events, which would mean that if we replayed the evolution, at least for this protein, and it might be the case for many others, for some forms of life, maybe we would result in totally different life forms.
It could also probably mean that if life developed elsewhere than on Earth, it could have very different form.
Yes, exactly. And this points to astrobiology, really. So it's about tracking the beginnings of life here to get some idea of what life could have been like on other planets. If we discover some primitive forms on other planets that are, that we believe that they used to be present on Earth, then we can believe that those primitive forms on other planets discovered, they might not necessarily result in having similar life forms on those planets like we have on our planet, on Earth. The life may take totally different course on other planets, and also there are totally different factors there, like atmosphere, the composition of it. It will definitely determine the trajectory of evolution. So this also gives us insight maybe on some planets. They are already some higher thinking forms living, which look totally different than we, even if we started the primitive life from something similar. So it's very interesting to study the evolution, if we can replay it exactly in the same way, or maybe alternative histories will be the result. Some different stories might be told.
From the perspective of science, are microbes the most perfect organism?
They can really withstand much of stress they are subjected to. So they are perfect in terms of genetic manipulation, for instance. So for our purposes, they are awesome. First of all, they don't ignite any bioethical discussions, right? Like some higher forms. And you can manipulate them in many ways. Of course, then they are assigned, they are labeled GMOs. So you have to be careful. Of course, they can spread very easily. And if they acquire some antibiotic resistance, it's better for them to be kept safe apart from the rest of the world in special parts of the lab, which are prepared for containing some.
Is your lab very much guarded?
Yeah, don't imagine some really thick layers of doors securing us, because we are not working with really hazardous microbes that can cause some severe diseases, but of course, we are very careful. We never trash samples, genetically modified samples, to the standard trash. They go to the specific biohazard bags. They are incarcerated. And so we make sure that they won't spread out, that they won't be released to the nature.
I will come back to something you said at the very beginning, and it was related to this, what you said about, I think, cyanobacteria, which you've been working with, they consume CO2, right?
Yes, exactly.
I couldn't help, and this is probably totally not related to your research, but think about global warming and big amount of CO2 in atmosphere. Could be like this kind of microbes who are consuming CO2 seen as some sort of a solution for... So I'm pretty sure you have more to say about it than me.
Oh, you just started a very interesting subject. Oh, yeah, definitely, yes. So increasing this house warming effect resulting in the release of high levels of carbon dioxide. And this is the substrate. This is the food for cyanobacteria. It just needs water, mineral salts, and access to light. So very simple things. So they might be very cheap to maintain, very cheap factories, actually, of some useful compounds while using carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So they can help to lower the level of carbon dioxide while producing something useful. It's not even utilizing carbon dioxide, but converting it into something really beneficial. Carbohydrates, right? So the cheap way to get the biomass which may be used to feed some other forms of life, which produce some other goods for us. This is very interesting. And your podcast is about fermentation. So, of course, cyanobacteria, they do ferment. They do produce lactic acid or ethanol as a result of fermentation. So you can think, just to improve them, that they do this efficiently, you would then have bacteria which produce bioethanol from carbon dioxide. So they not only clean our atmosphere from something that causes this global warming effect, but you have not only food but also fuel, and we need some new sources of fuel, and this would be very easy way to get them. It also points to possible application of cyanobacteria as carbon dioxide fixers to the missions, planetary missions. Like there is a concept of sending cyanobacteria to Mars. Why? If we think about creating some habitat for humans on Mars, if we ever go there, we want to make sure the most efficient and cost-effective way to establish life in there. It would be very difficult to bring the whole heavy equipment to start building bases, houses in there from metal or glass or some materials which would be hard to get from Earth, not only because of costs, but also because of the limitation of the space in the spaceship. So the new idea now being elaborated by the scientists from NASA is also to bring those houses, those infrastructures to build the habitats to the Mars, but basically maybe not to bring, but bring the source to recreate them on site once you are there. And it involves fungi. The major body of fungi is made of mycelium. It's a filamentous-like structure which forms precise filaments, and it may be used as a source of very rigid, very sturdy material. So you can transport spores of fungi, which are not very heavy and they don't involve so much, they don't take so much space. You can transport them on Mars, and they are also resistant to many, many harsh environment factors. You can transport them there, and then you can grow them. They just need water and what? And they need also organic materials, food. And this food might be provided by cyanobacteria. So Mars, the atmosphere of Mars is full of carbon dioxide. About 96% of atmosphere of Mars is composed of carbon dioxide. It's a primary food for cyanobacteria, so it would do quite well in there. You have some sunlight, you have water, mostly in a frozen form, and you have carbon dioxide. So they can produce food. So then this food might nourish fungi to produce the material to build habitats for humans.
Your research is related to kind of replaying the past while using the present, actually, the presently existing microorganisms, to imagine eventually like a future scenarios of evolution. Do we really need to know how some microorganisms from billion years ago looked? What for?
If we are interested in knowing how life which could be found undergo the process of evolution, so studying the evolution that have already happened on Earth, we can predict to some extent what it can look like on other planets as well. But then you can ask, okay, but so why we are interested in knowing what's happening on other planets? So this is all about basic applications. From more pragmatic approach, when you look at what we are doing, learning from the past might help you to find a way to manipulate this protein to ensure the better future. So to improve it, to continue the process of evolution, we try to reconstruct the previous history, but you may continue it yourself, knowing already the course of this evolution. its trajectory, you can try to further provide some selective pressure to evolve it into something you want, really. So this knowledge can really benefit even applicable sciences, I believe.
So basically bringing human touch to the randomness of this process. Thank you very much for your time and this great conversation.
Thank you. Thank you so much for hosting me.